Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everybody. We've got a delightful one today. You know, for a change, my guest is Mark Leibovich, author of the new number one New York Times bestseller, Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington, and The Price of Submission. I know Mark because he did a profile of me for the New York Times Magazine, where he worked for years and years, in 2016, and we've been friends ever since, although he kind of screwed me. Now, let me explain. He had come to Minnesota to follow me around for a few days. This is August 2016, and he's driving me to the state fair. Minnesota has the best state fair. Love our state fair. Well, 2 days earlier, Anthony Weiner had been caught sexting with a woman, not his wife, while laying in bed with his toddler son. As you might recall, this was kind of the last straw. This is after he had tried to rehabilitate himself. Now, Mark had recently done a Q&A for the Times Magazine with Weiner. And that morning, a New York City radio station had asked them if they could do an interview with him. And driving up to the fair, Mark was complaining about being looked to as an authority on Anthony Weiner. So, 5 minutes later, we walk up to the Farmers Union booth, and I get a call on my cell phone from my son, Joe. Now, Joe is a crazy, crazy, rabid Minnesota Vikings fan, something he got from his dad. And I answer the phone, and Joe is absolutely distraught. My son tells me that day in practice, this is preseason, Teddy Bridgewater, our number one draft, the guy who's going to be our franchise quarterback for the next 10, 15 years, Bridgewater sustained a freak non-contact, maybe career-ending, knee injury. Leibovich, who is from Boston and a huge Patriots fan, but a guy who loves watching the NFL, and a few years later writes a book, Big Game, about the NFL. Mark's watching me. Now, I'm distraught. I've been a Vikings fan since 1961, when, as an expansion team, we won our first NFL game against the Chicago Bears. I listened to that game on the radio because it wasn't televised. Vikings fans, along with Buffalo Bills fans, are the longest suffering fans in the NFL. Both teams have lost 4 Super Bowls and neither has won one. Now I'm distraught. I'm literally going, no, Jesus, no, non-contact. Oh, Jesus. Oh, no. So finally, I get off the phone, and I'm reeling. And Mark asked me what happened, and I told him. My son just told me that Teddy Bridgewater just sustained a terrible knee injury that may be career-ending. And he asked something like, how did that make you feel? And because we had just been talking about Anthony Weiner, and because we are just 2 months away from the 2016 presidential election, I say, it's like finding out that Hillary's having an affair with Anthony Weiner. So the next day, Mark tweets out, Al Franken, upon hearing of Vikes QB Teddy Bridgewater's knee injury, quote, it's like finding out Hillary's having an affair with Anthony Weiner. Now, we had agreed that he was writing a New York Times Magazine profile. There was nothing about tweeting. And naked, nothing about the context, which is that he had just spent the previous 20 minutes bitterly complaining about being thought of as an Anthony Weiner expert. And because he's a sniveling coward, Mark waited until the next day as he was hightailing it out of town, pushing the tweet button as his plane took off from the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport. Now, my team immediately goes into crisis mode. I have to make a public, abject apology, not just to Hillary, but to every American who's rooting for Hillary to win. Here's how Politico reported it. Senator Al Franken let his comedic past get the better of him on Wednesday, apologizing after joking that an injury to a Minnesota Vikings player was akin to Hillary Clinton having an affair with Anthony Weiner. Well, soon after, Mark called me and made an abject apology himself, which, like a chump, I accepted. And once you accept an apology, it means you've forgiven the person, I think. Anyway, you know what Stuart Smalley would say? Forgiving is forgetting. Forgiving is forgetting. And actually, Mark and I are good friends now. But as you will learn right at the top of the interview, my political consultant, Mandy Grunwald, has been warning me for years that members of the press are not your friends. It's complicated, isn't it? Politics and public life. And that's what Mark's book, Thank You for Your Servitude, is about. It's about how Republicans in Washington, virtually all of them, with just very few exceptions, they caved. They caved to Trump. I saw it myself, one after another of my Republican colleagues in the Senate who had nothing but contempt for Trump when he was running, ended up sucking up to him both privately and publicly. Guys like Rubio and Cruz and Lindsey Graham, who Trump had trashed. Remember Trump called Cruz's wife ugly and said that Cruz's father had something to do with the Kennedy assassination, that Cruz's dad was hanging out with Lee Harvey Oswald the day before the assassination. These guys had each called Trump a pathological liar. And like Kevin McCarthy and Paul Ryan and Reince Priebus, everybody just caved. This book is a great take on the Trump years, which, let's face it, we're still in. And also, it's a really funny book. Both of those are reasons that this is now the number one New York Times bestseller in nonfiction. You're going to really enjoy this conversation, you know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
We're friends?
No, we're not. We're your
oh, that's
politician,
right.
You're a public figure, and
Mandy will be so mad at me.
Yeah,
you gotta
don't. Hopefully, she's not listening.
Mandy Grunwald has been my you know, political advisor, media consultant. That's what you call her, mm-hmm. Washington. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she tells me that you're not my friend.
Yep. I can't be trusted. I'm a reporter. You know, he might seem personable.
Now, let me ask you this, because in this book, okay, it's thank you for your servitude.
You got to say the subtitle, too.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. Well, it describes it. There it is.
Yeah.
In this, it seems like people talk to you.
Yeah, it's always been a mystery. But yeah,
they had to because you're in the New York Times. So the New York Times assigns you to talk to them, I guess. Now, some of the times you're doing a profile of them. Well, you did a profile of me.
I did. That's how we met.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's how we almost became friends.
Oh, but we couldn't.
Yeah.
We couldn't. Right. It was frowned upon.
So these people say stuff to you. Almost all of them are Republicans. And what I loved about this book is that it's basically looking at the Trump administration from the standpoint of this horrible, 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 horrible guy that everyone knows is horrible, horrible, horrible. And yet everyone gives in.
Right. And people who know better, people who have real power. Real putative leaders of the Republican Party. Not, I mean, you know, it'd be one thing if, like, you know, Joe Schmo from Staten Island decides he doesn't like Donald Trump.
But this is everybody in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, Republican Washington with some exceptions, but yes, that's...
The only exceptions are, like, Flake.
There's some. No, I mean, I genuinely admire, you know, Jeff Flake and his principles. You know, Mark Sanford is another example. Liz Cheney, I think, is a towering example now. Not because, I mean, you know, there's a lot of liberals out there who will immediately say, how dare you say anything nice about Liz Cheney? I mean, because of the Iraq War, because of...
Well, she didn't do the Iraq War. Her dad did.
Well, she had a lot of the hawkish strains that her dad did.
I mean, she voted for Trump legislation 93% of the time, more than Meadows. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. No, I mean, look, my feeling is it's never too late to show courage. And once she decided that she was going to show courage and actually really believed that this was a fight worth
fighting. It wasn't a lack of courage to have her voting the way she did. She's a conservative,
correct.
Right? She's very conservative. So that wasn't a lack of courage.
Right.
It was... I mean, although before the January 6th, it was pretty plain who Donald Trump was.
I thought so. Yeah.
I thought it was plain who he was. You know, I was in a room with him maybe 8-9 times mm-hmm. in my time in when I was living in New York. Mm-hmm. And it was events that celebrities were invited to when I was in the room with him. Mm-hmm. I never once wanted to talk to him because I could tell.
Yeah.
Who he was, and I thought it was, wasn't it always obvious?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I agree. I actually thought, and I never paid any attention to him. I mean, obviously I knew who he was. I kind of tuned him out. I was happy to tune him out. I remember not reading much about him, although there was a great, great definitive profile of him written in the New Yorker in, I think, 1998, 99 by Mark Singer, mm-hmm. which I went back and read and still rings true. It was a brilliant profile. But, you know, I was happy not to think about the guy. I mean, I did find him compelling. Like, he'd go on Meet the Press a lot, and he sounded like a kind of a pragmatic, common sense guy, maybe very compelling. But, you know, the birther thing, to me, I mean, that was it. You know, Obama wasn't.
Well, born. What I loved about the birther thing, and this was a hint, and where he started finally being kind of on the horizon there, is that he would say, I've sent people to Hawaii.
My people.
My people, and what they're coming back with.
It's very disturbing. It's very bad.
Okay.
Very bad.
You know, he never sent anybody. You know, he never sent anybody.
Of course not.
And you know that he was just lying.
Yeah.
And everybody knew this. Now, everybody knew this.
It was a joke. It was a joke.
Okay. So you start early in the book, you start going, it's basically the other guys running against him.
Right.
Rubio looks really bad in this.
Yeah. He loved SNL, by the way. You know this.
I've told you that.
I know.
I love Collins. I have a Susan Collins quote here. There's no doubt that the president and I have extremely different styles.
The shoes.
See, that makes me laugh so hard. And this is what I'm laughing throughout this. And as you say, they're not jokes.
No, it's like, here, my feeling is, and I think, you know, you can obviously speak to this as well as anyone. This is not a funny story at its core. It's not a funny book at its core. It's not a funny time at its core. I mean, the stakes are miserably high, but...
But there's a thing called dark humor.
Well, and I think dark humor is an unmined resource from the Trump years. I mean, it obviously, you don't want to go up and like cover the White House like it's like, oh, get a load of this. Like, I never thought it was particularly funny that, you know, he made typos or on his tweets.
I'm no,
like, oh, wow, what a moron. Like, who cares?
No, I make typos.
No, but it's like there is scorn, ridicule.
Scorn and ridicule has its place.
Correct. But also, it's been unappreciated and I think uncalled out among a lot of the people who have to publicly defend him, even though they privately hate him. But, oh, we have different styles. Or, oh, I don't like the tweet.
We have different styles.
I mean, that's well, Senator, if you
maybe. Did you know that Collins now wants to make Maine an abortion destination?
Really? I mean, vacation land. Isn't that what it says on the license plate?
Yes. We have a beautiful rocky coastline. If you have to get an abortion, which I made possible.
So.
by confirming Gorsuch. If
you, what could you put on a license plate? Seriously. Vacation land on the
abortion land.
You know?
Okay. There's like a typical joke of yours. So, Rick Scott. Senator from Florida now decides this is post January 6th to present Trump at Mar-a-Lago with a Champion for Freedom trophy.
Made it up himself. He did. He made it.
It's a bowl. Like it's a bowl.
It's a bowl. Small bowl.
It's not even that big a bowl.
Nope.
And then you just write, did Obama ever win a Champion for Freedom trophy? We think not.
It's true.
That's what I like about
it. Well, what was great about it, though, was Trump was so proud to get this stupid little bowl, and he held it up, and Scott was in the picture, and they had a big press release, and it was at Mar-a-Lago. It was a very momentous event. I know the president was very moved.
Yeah, she announces this. She says, in your book, Kayleigh McEnany says, we need to be grateful for our president for that. Isn't it refreshing when contrasting it with the awful presidency of President Obama?
I mean, again, these are direct quotes. I know.
Well, okay, let me ask you something. When you go into an interview, and do you, like, before think about, I'm going to ask a question that I know will elicit a hilarious answer. Do you do that?
Yeah. I mean, not because I'm trying to make anyone look silly, but the bar of dialogue, politicians in on the record settings talk in complete trope and bullshit.
Yeah.
Much of the time.
Sure.
And by the way, this isn't a one-party thing.
They're supposed to,
but Democrats quite badly. I mean, unfortunately, Republicans for like 6-7 years have had to defend the indefensible, which they know full well. But no, you just ask questions and you listen and you ask simple follow-ups and you do it quickly. The one thing that reporters get in big, I think, really do themselves a disservice with is the long speech. Ooh. to sort of, because it gives them the time to think about, all right, what trope is going to go in? You know, mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of blame to go around. I don't like the president's style, but I think what we need to be focusing on is Joe Biden's blah, blah, blah. You know,
have you heard that a lot?
Yeah, of course. I mean, they all do. I mean, there were so many scenes over the years, though, where Trump would do something egregious. Like I remember there's actually a scene in the book. You remember the Lafayette Park thing? He sends the pulley there.
Were you there?
I was there.
You were there. That's in the book. You were there.
Yeah, I was there.
And then he goes to do the Bible upside down Bible.
Terrible thing. It was a terrible thing to watch. I mean, it was, you know, everyone saw it on TV, but I mean, it was like, oh, okay, this is Banana Republic. This is really bad. I mean,
horses.
It's like what you imagine Chicago in 68 was like, you know, just something just tipping right over the rails. And so, all right, Republicans can't be happy about this, right? I mean, this is like authoritarian behavior. So everyone marches up to the Hill the next day. It was a Tuesday, the caucus meetings, you know, the Senate people, and everyone parks themselves right outside the Republican caucus room.
This is reporters.
Reporters. Yeah. And you have the parade of people pretending to be on the phone. That's a, sorry, I can't talk. I didn't see the tweet. It's not a tweet. It's on.
We're doing the pinky thumb.
The pinky thumb. Yep.
But they, I did that. You know, I used to do that.
Oh, of course.
I would do the pinky thumb though.
Oh, so you wouldn't even have a phone in your hand.
No, I would do a pinky thumb and I go, sorry. And I point to my pinky thumb.
That's very smart. So you don't even need the instrument.
No. Then they'd go, okay, he's not going to say anything. And also, it's funny.
It's funny. Yeah. Yeah.
So I go, no.
No, but it's a joke. I mean, and it's embarrassing. And, you know, they just wanted to get into the lunch. And sorry, I didn't see it. Yeah. I remember actually Ted Cruz right after that said, he was the only one who kind of answered.
Oh, he actually gave an aggressive answer.
He did. He said, someone said, so Senator Cruz, what did you think of the conduct, you know, outside on Lafayette Square yesterday? I thought it was a terrible conduct by the protesters or something.
It was like it, worse than that. It was worse. Like disgrace.
A disgrace.
By the protesters.
Yeah. So.
Oh, I know the one I wanted to ask you. So where I'm thinking like, you know, this is going to get a funny answer. You're talking to Trump. And you went like, how are you? How's it going to be with you on empathy?
Mm. No. Here's how I framed it.
Okay.
Here's how I framed it. Yeah, I said, so we're sitting on his plane. And this was, I mean, late 2015. So he was the front runner. I kind of put off writing about him. And my no one at the Times magazine, that's where it was. They said, all right, finally, I guess we probably got to do this. And so he was very generous with his time and access and everything. I spent like all this time on his plane, in his cars, at his clubs, in his house, or at Trump Tower, everything. So we had this long flight from Dallas to L.A. because there was a debate. And he's just sitting there, basically spends the entire flight eating and looking up at the TV, watching himself at this rally he just did in Dallas. And whenever the cable news channel stopped talking about him, he would just flip to the other one and they'd inevitably be talking about him. And, you know, he just did this for much of the flight. And I was trying to ask him questions. And I said, finally, Mr. Trump, you know, every president has a moment of like what they're remembered for, kind of an empathetic moment that where they kind of are remembered for just sort of identifying with the victim, like Obama during like, Charleston, yes. And, you know, George W. Bush after 9/11, you know, went down to ground zero. I mean, there are moments like that. How are you going to do that? How do you think you'll rise to an occasion like that? And he said, and I think I used the word empathy in the question. Right, I said like presidential empathy moment. He goes, and he doesn't really look up from the TV. He goes, oh yeah, empathy. You got to have empathy. I think empathy will be one of the strongest things about Trump. And then he went back to watching. And then I think literally the next thing out of his mouth was, this asshole hates me. And it was some guy. Can you say that on your show?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. And so he points up and there was some pundit who has been very nasty to him. Mm-hmm. So that was literally the next thing.
But what was it?
Empathy will be one of the strongest things about Trump, I think.
About Trump.
Yes, about Trump. Yep. Yeah, that was a bizarre few weeks.
Because here's a guy, now, he is pathological.
Yeah.
And empathy is, he's incapable, right? No one's ever seen it, right?
No, yeah, I mean, no.
Remember in El Paso? He went down there.
Oh.
The
shooting.
Mass shooting.
Yeah.
And he took a picture with a baby who was orphaned in the shooting, and he just did a huge grin and a thumbs up.
Yeah, I think there was something. He was also pissed because, like, in the hospital, like, they weren't getting a picture of, like, he got some applause in the hospital, but they weren't letting the press in to see it. And, yeah, I remember reading that somewhere.
Okay. Basically, the premise of this whole book,
thank you for your servitude, Donald Trump's Washington, and the price of submission.
This is a way of viewing the Trump administration in terms of how the Republicans just bailed, in terms of having any integrity except for the less than a handful that you were able to mention. But this enabled this.
100%.
And I had, you know, I had colleagues, Republican colleagues, and I obviously left the Senate, but like, after the election, I couldn't believe it. I would actually get in touch with them and going, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. Like around certification, that kind of thing.
Certification, especially.
Yeah.
I had a friend who signed on and I went like, you can't, this will haunt you for the rest of your life.
And then the next day after he signed on, that's when the Raffensperger tape came out. And I go, and I texted him like, have you seen that?
Now, did he come around then?
You know what? If I tell you what he did,
all right, don't
figure out who.
I won't.
Or my audience will.
Yeah.
So I don't want to do that.
Yeah, because you know, if I were a real reporter, I would press you. But we're friends. Actually, no, we're not friends. Wait, we're not friends. So I'm going to add. No, I won't.
See, now you're getting confused about whether you're.
I'm very confused.
It was supposed to be that. You know, my problem.
I'm going to call Mandy. She'll clarify.
Okay, so this starts with Lindsey Graham is. You know, I know Lindsey. Lindsey's funny. He's the funniest.
Very approachable.
Very approachable.
Yeah. I've approached him.
Many, many times. And you write in the book that he told you, he said, you should have seen me in my youth. There was no question that I was heterosexual.
Okay. I wasn't asking. But yeah. Yeah, he was actually asked.
But you quote him as saying.
Well, he talked to, I think, a reporter. He told a reporter who brought this up, I think, explicitly. I don't remember where this was, but he said, I'm not gay. I hate to disappoint. The people will be like committing suicide by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. They'll be so disappointed to hear that. I mean, you know, it really takes it out a few notches there. But
well, Lindsey has a sense of humor.
Yeah, sure.
So once it's winter. We're about to go on vacation for the Christmas break. And he says, you going anywhere for sun with your family? And I said, yeah, we're actually going to Vieques in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And he said, do two fundraisers. One for the people who are for statehood. One for the people who are against statehood. They never talk to each other.
You know, that's a great Lindsey line.
Isn't it? Because his joke about himself is I'm shameless.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that kind of comes out in all your discussions with him. Also, once I was when he was running for president, I was next to him in the bathroom, the Senate bathroom. And I said, Lindsey, if I were a Republican, I'd be voting for you in the primary. He goes, that's my problem.
I mean, he's very quick.
He's very quick, very quick. Funny. But man, he's sort of needy. I mean, he has to be in the Senate.
You know, one of your colleagues said exactly that. He said there is no one who needs to be in the U.S. Senate more than Lindsey Graham. And you know, the crude way of looking at this is, oh, well, he doesn't have a family. He's got nothing else in his life and so forth. Yeah, I mean, maybe. But I mean, this is a guy who just gets a sustenance from, I mean, he says, I got to be at the dice table. He said, I'm addicted. I mean, like McCain was too.
McCain
was addicted. Dice. He liked the dice table. And Lindsey, you know, Lindsey looked for alpha.
And dogs. Of course, here's a tension here because McCain hated Trump.
Yeah, wasn't shy about it.
And Lindsey and McCain were besties, right? Absolutely. Three amigos with Lieberman.
With Lieberman, yeah.
So McCain expresses disappointment.
He did at the end. He did.
Yeah.
He did privately. I mean, you know, the stuff that sort of dribbled out about the public stuff were, you know, McCain saying, do you really have to say how good of a fucking golfer he is?
Because
Graham couldn't just like, you know, be sycophantic with Trump, like on policy. And he says, thank God for you. And thank God for you fixing all of Obama's messes. He's like, and man, you're a great golfer. And your courses are so beautiful. And he'd actually go on Twitter and say, what a spectacular golf course Trump International, wherever it is. that really tipped McCain over.
McCain could be funny.
Sure.
He also, you know, he could yell at you too.
Yeah. But absolutely.
That was him.
No, I really like McCain. I mean, I'm a cliche that way. I mean, reporters.
No.
He's a fascinating guy. Very, complicated.
And yet you point out, for example, in 2010, when he ran for reelection, he became so anti-immigration.
Yeah.
Build that wall.
Yeah.
So he was a politician. He had to be there.
He picked Sarah Palin. I mean, you know, he didn't think she was the most qualified. I mean, I think.
No, he wanted to pick Lieberman.
He wanted to pick Lieberman. Yeah. Man, it would, you know, they convinced him that anti-abortion, whatever, would just rebel inside the party. And that would be that.
Well, he maybe turned out to be right. Maybe. I don't know. Well, he lost anyway, didn't he?
He lost. I mean, you know, for about a week, Sarah Palin supposedly electrified the Republican Party.
At that convention speech.
Absolutely.
And I was
in St. Paul.
In St. Paul, and I was running for the Senate at the time, and I had never run for office before. Mm-hmm. And I looked at her and listened to her, and everyone got nervous.
She was terrific.
Speech at the, yeah. the speech was amazing. Yeah. I said, "Don't worry,
right?
She doesn't know anything. She's going to be terrible." Because I was running for the first time, mm-hmm. and there was stuff I didn't know about mm-hmm. politics or stuff like that. Yeah. And I knew that that was hard, mm-hmm. but I knew that she wasn't someone who seemed to have a strong intellectual bent.
Really? You pegged her for that, huh?
Yes. I'm a judge of character.
You're a good judge of character.
Absolutely. Why, we're friends. Oh, wait a minute. Shh. Ron Johnson told the Trump rally in Jamesville that Biden supporters, quote, don't particularly love America. Mm-hmm. I love shit like that. That is amazing. Well, that's what's great about this book is that you kind of collect stupid shit went by so fast every day, yeah, every day during Trump. One or two or three things, and yep. you forget them. But you, in this book, you get to laugh, you know.
You know, I will say I had a great team of researchers.
Really?
Well, they work for a company called Google.com. I don't know if you – no, but, you forget stuff.
Except
but,
didn't you – you may forget stuff, but you were – how – when did you know this was your book? That's a good question.
When did I know I was writing a book or that the book would be focused on the enablers?
Either one. The second one.
The second one was fairly late in the game, and I owe a great debt of gratitude to my editor, Scott Moyers. I mean, I had a lot of material. I mean, I've been covering this shit for
a long time.
I mean, I've been working, and, so I've had a lot of exposure. I mean, I've been at events, I've been in rooms, I've been around things happening, been around Trump. I mean, so I had material. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll just do This Town for the Trump Years, mm-hmm. because This Town was successful.
This Town was a book was that the you first wrote book, about first Washington Morey.
Yeah, and it did well. And I figured, all right, this is all this colorful shit. And then I was writing, and Scott Moyers, my editor at Penguin, very encouraging. He's like, this is great. Just keep going, keep going, keep going. And then, about 50,000 words in, he said, all right, at this point, we need to figure out what the book's about. And from what I can tell from the material, I mean, basically, I'm paraphrasing.
Boy, this is an editor doing more than I've ever heard an editor do.
Well, what was great was Scott said, look, many authors, and I'm one of them, will tell you that you don't really know what the book's about until you're fairly far in. And he said, these guys are the most interesting.
That's not necessarily true.
Well, I thought, look, I didn't want to
kill a mockingbird. She knew what she was doing.
Probably. Yeah. Oh, there's no question. I mean, yeah, okay. Not in every case, but I didn't want to write a Trump book. I thought Trump was uninteresting. I thought he'd been done to death.
Well, that's why this is really fun to read, because it's not so much about Trump. It's about his enablers.
Correct.
Yeah. That's what this book is about. And it's shameful. And each one after another looks so stupid.
Yeah.
Paul Ryan looks stupid. Lindsey Graham looks stupid. Nikki Haley looks stupid. Rubio looks stupid. This is funny. This is Spicer talking about how great the Trump Hotel was before he gets in. Mm-hmm. He says, I think it's symbolic of the kind of government that's been around.
I thought that was true.
And there's Conway. The family, beginning with President Trump, have made financial sacrifices to be president of the United States. Okay. Yeah. Now, Jared came back with how much from Qatar? $2 billion?
Yeah.
$2 billion?
Yeah, it was so much. Yeah. Can you imagine if, like, Bill Clinton's son-in-law did that? I hate like the construction where, hey, can you imagine if Obama did that? I mean, it's like you could do that forever.
But during the which impeachment was, I think, the first one, they were going after Hunter Biden, of course, because that was the whole point.
Burisma,
right? That was the whole point.
Yeah.
And I just kept telling my colleagues, just talk about Jared and Ivanka. And they wouldn't do it because they wanted to be above it.
Yeah. Also, you don't want to get the family involved.
So I submitted a question to a couple of my former Democratic colleagues during the impeachment. I said, the Trump defense team kept saying that Trump was really worried about corruption in Ukraine. And the question I submitted was, Can you point to any other point in his lifetime when Donald Trump was concerned with corruption?
And okay, that's a really good question. That would
I actually think
for the impeachment. That was
I think, you know, a real, real occupational failing among senators, congressmen, you know, when you're questioning witnesses or reporters, when you're questioning subjects, sources, whatever, is asking too long questions. And again, it's like if you ask a very quick and simple question, they don't have time to think. Well, I mean, like, you know, the way you questioned Jeff Sessions, I mean, that elicited.
That actually wasn't.
It wasn't. I mean,
it was him. I asked.
You asked the question, so you get credit.
But I didn't even ask the question that he answered. I don't know if people give me amazing credit for you're the reason that Mueller ended up being the guy. And I went, well, yeah, but what I did was I said to Sessions, if it turned out that people in the Trump campaign, surrogates, had interacted with the Russians, would you recuse yourself? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I did not have any. I didn't even ask him that.
Yeah.
And then it turned out he did.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
So I should not give myself credit for that. Okay, here's a quote I took out. Will you please like me?
Oh, that was Trump. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you just missed so much stuff. It was Trump when his approval ratings among suburban women especially were just like just in the toilet. And
here's here's from the book. Will you please like me? He pleaded from the stage at an October rally in Jonestown, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So much of like the blizzard of material has been lost to the blizzard of material, right? I mean, right. Even recently in the
That's hearing, what's great about the book, which is that you can't remember what happened last week because in the interim, eight terrible things or ridiculous things have happened. And then it's also, you don't want to ever go back and Google ridiculous things that Trump
No.
So you can't do that. So then you go like, wow, I wish I could enjoy all the awful things that happened. I mean, and then you get to do this because you write in a way that's fun and funny.
You know what I wish I had time to do? This happened too recently to put in the book. It happened like a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Which I just cannot believe people are not lingering on just a little bit. In the January 6th committee interview with Jared, where he was asked about, you know, Cipollone, who said, you know, kept saying, you know, this is wrong, you know, January 6th is wrong. And Jared at one point sort of said, yeah, I thought he was showboating because, you know, I was just mostly just preoccupied with like giving people pardons. He said, that was my assignment now. I wasn't really engaged in this. I was just focused on finding people that we should pardon. That was his portfolio. It's like, oh, okay, Judge Jeanine's ex-husband, got to pardon him. You know, all right, do we do the Bannon thing here? Do we do this donor here? Or do we do Flynn here? I mean, it's just one after another.
The Kushner saying he was in charge of pardons. Well, of course, because there's money in pardons.
I mean, just he just was so, look, I was just really busy finding people to pardon. That was the other thing. I remember Trump on his final plane ride to Mar-a-Lago, they reported what his in-flight meal was, which was steak over cheesy grits with an egg over. I mean, it was very nutritious.
It's hard to believe he's overweight.
Well, it's hard to believe he's like, he doesn't appear to have major health problems. I mean,
there is someone in your book who says we're just waiting for him to die, right?
A Republican, congressman.
Mm-hmm.
Said that. He said, we have no plan to deal with him. I mean, you know, he's a problem for them. You know,
this is post January 6th.
Yeah, we have no plan. And then this congressman, I don't endorse this, but this congressman said, we're just waiting for him to die. That's our only plan. And he was 100% serious.
And that, to me, as a reader, was a laugh.
It's dark. but it goes to the passivity of these Republicans.
That's a good point.
No, it's just like, we're not going to do anything about it. We're just going to sit back and wait for God to intervene.
This one made me laugh. So it's Rubio. Rubio thinks he's making a move in the campaign.
Yes,
right?
He is. Yeah.
And he gets excited about an endorsement. Hmm. But he says, we got Toomey.
Oh, this was Nevada.
we got Pat Toomey.
Yep.
And to me, that's just hilarious.
Amazingly, the Republican voters of Nevada, the caucus voters, were not following Pat Toomey's lead. But what was funny was that was when Rubio is seen as the guy to stop Trump, right? And Trump was just, you know, raking up these big victories like all over the country, and Nevada was like the last stand, I guess, for Rubio. And the establishment kept endorsing him, and every day they'd roll out new endorsements, like, "Oh, we got
Lamar Alexander,
we got Bob Dole, Lamar Alexander, George Pataki." And I remember I was with Rubio; I was doing a story on him, and I was sitting next to him on his campaign plane. We were going from like Reno to Vegas, or Vegas to Reno—I forget which direction—and you know, he had like a plane load of these big time endorsees, like the lieutenant governor of Nevada just came out for him. And he goes, "We can feel their momentum. And, you know, we got Toomey today.
We got Pat
Toomey. Yeah. And again, I mean, talk about a powerhouse in Nevada.
Well, I guess that must happen. Like, you're in the campaign and an aide fake. "We got Pat Toomey." And then he's excited for the moment. And he's with Mark Leibovich. And he goes, we just got Pat Toomey.
Yeah.
And that's why I laugh at that line.
Thank you for recognizing that. See, to me, it's all in the interstitial details like that.
But to me, that's just hilarious.
Isn't it?
"We got Pat Toomey."
I mean, it would be one thing if we're going from Johnstown, Pennsylvania to Aliquippa, Pennsylvania.
Oh, and then Rubio did the small hands thing.
Yeah, but the joke killed. It was a college in Virginia somewhere.
Did it? I remember as a
college kids loved it.
Did Ruby, I think in the book expresses some regret.
Yeah, a little bit about his conduct. Yeah, he did. Yeah,
about that specific joke, was it?
Just his general conduct getting into the mud because, you know, he has children, doesn't want to be remembered that way. I mean, Rubio was, I think, sincere, like in his utter despair over what Trump had done to him and done to the party. And, you know, when I first got to know Rubio, I mean, he talked like a real true believer as far as his family story coming from Cuba and, like, you know, what it's terrible. He said there's a great danger in having a big charismatic leader who has authoritarian tendencies like Fidel Castro. And there's going to be a reckoning in the Republican Party for years to come about how we fell in with this guy, meaning Trump. And he wasn't saying "we" then, because he was quitting the Senate. He had announced his,
you know,
running again.
Yeah.
Said, I would, you know, someone's told the Washington Post, a friend of his, you know, he's miserable. He'll be thrilled to be out. And, you know, then he realized a couple months later, I mean, shit, I won't have a parking space come.
I won't have a huge staff.
He course corrected. And you know what his reason was? Now that it's clear that the Democratic nominee will be Hillary Clinton. Because, you know, that came out of nowhere. No one saw that. You know, he said, "Oh, well, I can't, you know, I don't trust this guy with a nuclear code, but I cannot imagine who could have thought that Hillary Clinton
would be the nominee
of the Democratic 16. Party.
No one comes off, well, as I said, very, very, very few people come off very good. Barr. Mm-hmm. Barr completely mischaracterizes the Mueller report.
Yeah.
And you say this would quickly become total exoneration. Trump's off-tweeted words. Hey, wait, but Mueller explicitly claimed the opposite. He even complained to Barr in a dreaded italics. Sharply worded letter. I
mean, when you write a sharply worded letter, it's you know, Democrats, by the way, over the years have made great use of a sharply worded letter. They wrote a lot of them to Trump.
Yeah, Mueller was a little bit of a disappointment. Mm. What is the downside?
Oh, boy.
What is the downside for humoring him for this little bit of time, a senior Republican official was quoted as saying in the Washington Post. The blind quote oft repeated.
This was right after the election, right?
Yeah, after the election, before January 6th. What is the downside for humoring him for this little bit of time? Oh, I don't know.
There's a little bin we have over here for the quotes that don't age well. Okay. Maybe we can put that.
Who was that? We don't know.
Well, we don't know. It was quoted over and over and over. It took on a life of its own. And, you know, it's like, look, it's the Republican platform was humoring him.
We'll be right back with Mark Leibovich, author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Thank You for Your Servitude.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're back with Mark Leibovich.
We'll skip ahead past the early pandemic days. Trump's inability to feel or even fake empathy.
Despite what he told me.
That's right. Okay, we talked a little bit about that, the faking empathy. The inability to handle the coronavirus. I mean, I think any malignant narcissist of even average intelligence would have understood this is the biggest global crisis we've had. This means really that I have to lead. And by the way, if I do this well, I will be reelected.
You're shoo-in.
Absolute I am a fucking shoo-in. So he immediately puts it to the states. Immediately just gives it to the states because he doesn't want to take any. But this is like Roosevelt, FDR, after Pearl Harbor, saying, this is really kind of Hawaii's problem. You know?
You're right, though, by the way. I mean, this was, everyone was like, oh, he's been dealt a terrible hand. I mean, no one wanted the coronavirus. I mean, that was a bad hand that we were all dealt and continue to be dealt. However, from a pure political standpoint, I mean, this is a classic crisis that just baseline acceptable.
As you point out, governors got kudos for handling
both parties. Absolutely. I mean, Andrew Cuomo, despite everything and before times was... You know, should we run for president? You know, whatever.
But other Republican governors, absolutely. Hogan.
Oh, Larry Hogan, Charlie Baker.
Yes, you're right.
There were many Republicans who gained.
And then many who didn't, of course.
Yeah, there were some.
And
although, you could argue that from a different perspective in the way the Republican Party of today thinks and the Florida electorate thinks, you know, Ron DeSantis may be benefited. I don't know. I mean, who knows?
Well, he'll probably be reelected.
Probably. It's not a sure thing.
Really?
Well, Charlie Crist, I mean, it's a pretty close poll.
Is it? Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah. I don't like him.
All right. Okay. Damn. So, you don't like Trump. You don't like DeSantis. So, what, you're a Pence guy? Is that?
What the hell is with Pence? You know, we know now that Trump thought it was justified that the crowd, he liked the idea of the crowd, then the crowd wanted to hang him. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, if I'm Pence.
That would piss me off.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah. That would piss me off. Especially a guy who thinks that empathy is such a strong suit, you know?
Man, was he, what's the word for how he was the vice president? What would you? You're a good wordsmith.
You know, he was very loyal. He was,
what's the downside of what he was?
He was a doormat. He was, well, no, what was interesting about him.
Okay, that's better.
What was interesting about him is someone was, I had forgotten I'd written it the other day. Someone read it on TV, but he, Pence used to talk about the broad-shouldered leadership of Trump. That was like, he said it like 18 times. Mm-hmm. I admire the strongness of my president and our president. And
what an honor. Strength?
But he kept talking, whatever he said, okay. the strength. Okay. I mean, but he kept talking about the broad-shouldered leadership of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And that was just weird.
He physically does have broad shoulders, doesn't he? I mean, at least.
I don't know if he was being literal.
I know, but. It's not.
I mean, there's a great. Okay, so there's a good portion, like maybe 4 or 5 pages here, is devoted to that incredible, incredible, almost surreal cabinet meeting in 2017. It was the first meeting of the complete cabinet after whoever the last cabinet member to get confirmed was. And basically, TV cameras were allowed in for the first 10 minutes or so before they got down to business. And you know, Trump was feeling kind of bad about himself. And, you know, Mueller, the Mueller report, he was just pissed off at everyone. He was in a bad mood.
At this point, the Mueller thing.
No, but he had been appointed. But he was in a bad place. And so his staff decided that at the beginning of the cabinet meeting, it might buck up the president if you know, he got a little special praise while the TV cameras were there. So Reince Priebus kicks it off and talks about the blessing it is. Well, he didn't kick it off, but he, you know, he was the chief of staff, so he kind of was the ringleader of this. And they would just go around the table, and every cabinet member was called upon to just heap praise. And they just went around one or more over the top of the other. Jim Mattis, to his credit, did not play.
He was the one to piss
Trump off.
The defensor.
But God, Pence kicked things off at the beginning and said, Mr. President, thank you, thank you, thank you for this and for the just being respected around the world and for getting things done and delivering on all your promises. I mean, whatever he said, making America's. And just he had this, obviously the hushed reverence, the bowed head, the just the sort of ramrod posture and behind with a sort of like squinty look that would never, no matter what the president was saying, he would just look like this. Like, and you can't see me, but... You know, like nod his head.
I can for the audience.
I mean, just military.
He's doing a face exactly like Mike Pence. Like Mike.
Yes, thank you, Al, for illustrating that. But so it was. It was. But
the
so,
reverence, the reverence,
the reverence. No, and he was so loyal to him to the bitter end. And what was interesting is I talked to a bunch of people who know Pence, you know, mainly Republican House members who served with him. And they were always trying to get him to break, like, you know, offline, but without any cameras, they'd be like, Mike, are you in there somewhere? Like, you got to know this is nuts, right? You got to, I mean, you know, we've known each other a long time. Like, tell me this isn't like the loony bin it looks like. I mean, you got to be like killing yourself. And the amazing thing about Pence was even privately, except for, I guess, a very small circle, he wouldn't go there because he very smartly knew either get back or someone would like say anonymously to the press, you know, yeah, Pence in private thinks he's a real idiot. I mean, even something like that.
Well, that's what you were, a lot of people are saying that kind of stuff to you.
Oh.
Not about Pence, but everybody else.
Yeah.
And that's what's.
I never got the sense, though, that Pence was one of the guys talking shit about Trump like so many other people around the White House and the Republican Party.
I mean, what does Pence think after he heard from through the January 6th hearings that he was happy that people wanted to hang? I don't know. Mike Pence probably doesn't listen to the Al Franken podcast.
I know that.
But if someone who does knows him, if Pence ever wants to do a stand-up.
Can you imagine?
If Pence just, that was it. If that was it for him, that the report that Trump was actually kind of happy that people wanted to hang him. If that's it, if that makes him do a 180 and he wants to go out and do 10 minutes, I will write that for him.
Oh, it would be, yeah, you'd think. Right. But they asked Pence's brother the other day.
At a gridiron dinner. Right, the next gridiron dinner, we have Mike Pence.
You know, the last gridiron was pretty good. Didn't was it Christie? Christie gave a really funny speech. And Chris Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire, really funny speech. He said he's nuts. I mean, they went there, but they're more, you know. But no, if Pence were to do that, oh boy.
No, and also, I think it was Jamie Raskin. Did he do the Democratic one?
I think he did, yeah. Who's funny. I didn't realize
he did. Yeah, and he said something about Christie's book.
Oh, well, Trump, you know, kind of got, I mean, Trump loves books that don't sell.
Well, so did, well, that's Christie.
Yeah, didn't do well. I did read his books. I read both of the books.
I read the book, but so I did an event with Christie.
Really? He's a funny guy.
He is. And so I told him, this is, so we meet about a half hour before the event. And I said to him, okay, this is how I want to start.
Wait, when was this?
This was, I don't know, 6 months ago or something. Mm-hmm. So I say, this is how I want to start. I'm going to say, Governor, I read your book, and I was very moved by the chapter where you were in the ICU, and at one point you thought you might not make it, and you said to, you called your wife, and you said to her, if they're going to intubate me, you can't talk when you're intubated. I have to talk to the kids first. And of course, I was very moved by that, and of course, you made it, and then I want you to say, thank God I didn't have any comorbidities.
Did you say that to Christie?
Yeah. And he,
did he play along?
He laughed and right, said, good, you good. Got it. And so, and he understood that I was giving him the punchline.
Yeah.
And so we did it and it got a huge laugh.
Oh, that's
and then nice. We did a fist
bump. Can I just say, because in the book, Trump concurrently was in the ICU at Walter Reed. So they were in the ICU at the same time.
That's right.
Or they were being treated in the hospital at the same time. And so Trump calls Christie, you know, because he's an empathetic guy, to see how he's doing. He said, Chris, how you feeling? I'm worried about you. And after a few minutes, he kind of got to the point of the call. And he said, you're not going to say you got this for me, are you? He said, you know, because it wouldn't look good. Because, you know,
Christie writes that in his book.
He does. And then I asked him about it in an interview. And he said, oh, that was actually the one laugh I had in the ICU. This guy will never change. And
in his telling of it in the book, he gets to it faster.
Oh, so you're saying he told it better than I did?
In the book.
It happened to him. He's alive.
It was not a lot of, how are you doing?
You're not going to say you got this from me. Got right to the point. Well, you know, the president's a busy guy. He's a busy guy. He's got a lot. I mean, because, you know, Christie was like his debate prep guy. They were like in these very small rooms together, presumably. So,
Did you read? You read Christie's
book. I did.
You know who comes off well in that book? Christie.
Really?
Yes.
God, it's amazing how
didn't
that
you notice?
Works.
Yeah. I underlined.
Oh, yeah. You mean when he was like, I told the president that he was wrong here.
Yeah.
I said, Mr. President, you got to get out in front of this coronavirus.
Well, and there's also just a lot of people saying, like, what you talk to the president that really made an impression on him. Thank you.
Yeah.
And there's just, I just started highlighting it.
Did you really?
Yeah, right. Because it's, I think I still have it. Yeah. If we get together ever, I'm going to show you the highlighted version of self-praise.
It is amazing. No, I mean, he was like the consummate self-portrayed adult in the room.
It's fun, isn't it, to do this?
Yeah.
To write about politics and the follow.
Yeah, this is tough. The Trump years have been tough. I want to say,
it's fun and it's really dark. Disheartening.
You know, the stakes are really, really high.
Really high.
I mean, if I can be earnest here for a second.
Let's do that.
No, I mean, over the years, I mean, I was sort of seen as a professional cynic many years. Yeah. Like I wrote, you know, this book about Washington.
This town.
And I come to that, honestly, I concede I'm very cynical about politics and politicians and the media and our whole world that we inhabit. But the one thing about the Trump years is that it made me realize how much I care and how much my colleagues care and, frankly, how much a lot of politicians, but probably not enough politicians, care. Because this stuff is really for keeps. Like, people talk about, our democracy is at stake. And, you know, your first reaction is like, okay, that's overheated. Maybe you want to roll your eyes. But no, it's 100% true. What's going on in state election, you know, with state election boards and state legislatures.
And this new thing that the Supreme Court is from North Carolina.
North Carolina. Oh, I mean, that's almost existential.
Right? Yes.
I mean, there's that.
We overuse existential.
No.
This is not existential.
I mean,
that, of course, is the independent legislature doctrine.
Yeah.
Which is that state legislatures are in charge of federal elections and can basically do anything.
Bottom line, it will make it much easier to steal the next election or election.
Yeah, it's the piece that's exactly what Eastman wanted them to do. That's serious.
This is what gets me angry. And then, you know, people throw around, oh, there's going to be a civil war. And, you know, I hope there's not a civil war.
Malcolm Nance thinks.
Well, you know, you hear that and it doesn't sound insane, but I'm pointing to the cover of my book. I'm pointing to, you know, Ted Cruz and Mitch McConnell and Rudy Giuliani and Mike Pence and all of them, McCarthy, you know, Lindsay. They all know this. They all, I think, on some level know the stakes of it, and they are just trying to get through the day-to-day machinations of pleasing Trump or keeping him somewhere just getting to the next election. You know, Mitch McConnell might be having such despair over, oh, I got to deal with Herschel Walker, but Mitch McConnell got his 3 Supreme Court judges and, you know, justices, and they all got something out of the deal. I'm not sure they're having fun, and I'm not sure what they think about when they're alone. But to me, the stakes are extremely high, and that's what really pisses me off about the people who know better. That was the working title of this book as I was working.
People who know better?
They all knew better.
They all knew better. That could have been the subtitle.
Could have been. Yeah, I mean, it sounded a little... A little over the top, but no, look, it's
judgmental. But the book is Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. Great book.
Thank you, Al.
Congratulations.
Thanks. It was fun. Love being on with you.
Yeah. Well, I meant for the book, not for being on with me.
I appreciate the congratulation.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the 3 most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.